This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents A Mouse Divided, written by Jeff Ryan, performed by J.D. Jackson.
Prologue. The God of Childhood. A mouse doesn't look very human. It's tiny. We're big. Mice ears are large. Their nose is busy. Their eyes small and beady. Their bodies differ from ours as well. Four stomachs, nictitating membranes, Hardarian glands and sensory organs called vibrissae, better known as whiskers. But a force beyond biology makes us Homo sapiens kin to Mus musculus. Mice somehow are just like us. The mouse is a hunted animal. All manner of birds, snakes, and even bugs kill and eat them. Our ancestors domesticated cats and dogs simply to chase them off. Mice eat through wires and packages, leave spoor and spread disease. Yet they aren't hated in the way ants, spiders, or roaches are. The cute factor is just too high. Their round, liquid black eyes, their squeaks, that look of permanent surprise. For vermin, they're adorable. It is almost too easy to draw parallels between the mouse-human relationship and that of the Walt Disney Company and society. Disney Inc. is everywhere. It is adored by kids and tolerated, if not quite loved, by adults. Disney cannot ever be stopped, only its damage minimized. But the octopus might be a better animal mascot for Disney, with tentacles extending to all types of media and entertainment. Or maybe the animal should be a whale. The Walt Disney Company employs close to 200,000 people with a market cap of $162 billion. For comparison's sake, the Milky Way has 100 billion stars. Disney is a behemoth, but even behemoths have beginnings. Disney wouldn't exist without Walt Disney, of course, the cartoonist who made his last name the good housekeeping seal of approval for family entertainment. But where would Walt be, in turn, without Mickey Mouse? Mickey was the collateral by which Walt built his empire. If he could make the world fall in love with such a critter after all, he could do anything. Mickey Mouse is more than a cartoon mouse. He has become shorthand for everything from Disney's corporate governance to its artistic decisions to its current crop of T-shirts. Mickey is name-dropped in culture with the same ease as Ahab for obsession, Einstein for brains, or Mother Teresa for selflessness. No one and nothing is as globally associated with children as Mickey Mouse. Sorry, Santa. Don't even say Mickey. Just mention the mouse, and you're transitively referring to Disney. A visitor to our Disney-fied culture would see Mickey Mouse as a religious figure. That visitor would not be wrong. We worship Mickey, we sing his praises, we tell his story, we iconize him, and we go on pilgrimages to his holy sites. Are you a member of Mickey's flock? Let's see. Count how many graven images of Mickey are in your house. Storybooks, embroidered socks, old VHS tapes, wine stoppers, cloisonné pens. It adds up. Compare it with artifacts of your actual religious beliefs. Mickey will probably win. Walt Disney was not the first to anthropomorphize a mouse. Everyone from Aesop to Beatrix Potter to Lewis Carroll beat him to the punch. Human-like mice are abundant nowadays. The Tale of Despero, Mouse, Stuart Little, Pikachu, Fievel, Speedy Gonzales, and Reepicheep all share a genus and species with Mickey. There was no better name for the cursor-moving computer accessory than mouse. Most of the world believes not in a tooth fairy, but in a tooth mouse. Mice are always David, never Goliath. No team mascot has ever been named the mice. Not counting the Sorcerer's Apprentice and Steamboat Willie, can you name any other Mickey Mouse cartoon? Have you seen any? Mickey is the biggest paradox in popular culture. A globally beloved character no one seems to know anything about. The last two dozen times you've seen Mickey have probably been as a design element, a silhouette, those quintessential three circles. This characteristic characterlessness is purposeful. To modern eyes, Mickey is a symbol, perhaps the symbol for contemporary Western life. Mr. Mouse looms large. So who was he? Disney animator Ted Sears taught a generation of animators how to approach Mickey, or in this case, how not to. Mickey is not a clown, Sears wrote. He is neither silly nor dumb. His comedy depends entirely upon the situation he is placed in. How old is Mickey? His age varies with the situation, Sears said. Sometimes his character is that of a young boy, and at other times, as in the adventure type of picture, he appears quite grown up. Mickey seems best defined by what he is not, neither adult nor kid, not silly or dumb, not mean or bossy, certainly not a real mouse. Mickey was the blank cell upon which you inked your own face. Mickey is seldom funny in a chase picture, as his character and expressions are usually lost, Sears stressed. Mickey is most amusing when in a serious predicament, trying to accomplish some purpose under difficulties or against time. When Mickey is working under difficulties, the laughs occur at the climax of each small incident or action. They depend largely upon Mickey's expression, position, attitude, state of mind, and so on, and the graphic way that these things are shown. It's easy to say Mickey was Walt Disney's alter ego, but Walt was a walking enigma who no one understood. The mystery is doubled. The key to understanding Mickey and Walt Disney comes from one hidden fact. Walt was Mickey's father, yes, but he wasn't Mickey's only father. I entered this project having written a book about a video game icon, Super Mario. Nintendo purposefully treats Mario as its Mickey Mouse. Tackling the Big Cheese himself seemed like the next step. But I knew next to nothing about Mickey or Disney. We didn't have a collection of the movies growing up. I made it to adulthood without seeing Mary Poppins or Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We never made a family outing to Walt Disney World or Disneyland. I never owned mouse ears. I did watch some Disney Channel as a boy, but I preferred Goofy to Mickey. First things first, I'd need a solid footing on the source material. That meant more than just calling a family vacation to Orlando a tax write-off. I'd have to read up on the Walt Disney Company, how it went from cartoon shorts to a global gargantua, and learn everything I could about the early years of animation, and old-time Hollywood, and the Great Depression, and World War II. It took a while. Time to compare Disney with one more animal, the elephant. In a folktale, six blind men touch an immense pachyderm. One feels a trunk, one grabs an ear. No one can grasp the entirety of the beast. Like many biographers, I spend a few months feeling around for new information, somewhere between the tail and the trunk, which no one had discovered. The legendary Disney archives have enough Disneyana inside their walls for 100 years of research. It is to Mickey Mouse what that warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark is to historical artifacts. With rare exception, though, only Disney employees are allowed entry. My requests for research were denied. Even if I were admitted, it would take months to pore through all the Depression-era papers, documents, films, and photographs. That's a practical reason why researchers are denied entry. It's not user-friendly. Better than access to the archives, though, would be access to Walt's friends and family, the people who made Mickey out of ink and paint. In 1967, the year after Walt Disney died from lung cancer, biographer Richard Hubler was commissioned by the Disney family to write an authorized biography of their father. Hubler interviewed everyone he could at Disney, his wife Lillian, his brother Roy, his two daughters Diane and Sharon, plus all his compatriots from over the years. Hubler's style was frequently brusque, apparently done to break the glass of hagiography. He presumably wanted to let his subjects know they could feel free to paint a warts and all version of Walt Disney, but the transcripts often came off as a callous interviewer insulting a dead man to his friends and family. Friends and family did talk to Hubler. Then they talked among themselves and made a decision. When Hubler handed in his draft, the family refused to publish it. As a reporter, Hubler could be brassy and insensitive, but as a writer he was judicious, fair-minded, and compassionate. I suspect the Disney family's decision not to authorize the book's release came from the off-putting interview style, not the even-handed manuscript that resulted. The end result, however it happened, was the same. The book was canned, locked away deep in the Disney archives. Canned, though, is not the same as destroyed. One copy survives, in a box at Boston University's Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Next to that is another box filled with notes, rough drafts, and a few hundred pages of transcribed interviews. Many of these are incomplete because Hubler would cut and staple a choice quote onto his typewritten page. Some of his pages were up to 2 feet long. No photocopying is allowed in the archive, only handwritten notes. To preserve the paper from oily skin, I had to wear white cotton gloves at all times. So I researched Mickey Mouse while cosplaying as Mickey Mouse. In return, I discovered hundreds of new quotes, facts, dates, and perspectives. During the days I was there, I moved my pencil faster than my mind could process, becoming a human mimeograph machine. I've incorporated Hubler's research throughout the book. That's material not found anywhere else, as far as I know. This isn't a scholarly book, but I do want to give credit where credit is due. At my website, amousedivided.com, I have a list of all the quotes I've pulled from Hubler's notes, as well as a bibliography of the hundreds of books, articles, and websites I've read over the years. They'd be here in print, but I ran out of room. You can also find chapter-by-chapter playlists of all cartoons mentioned in the text. This is not a book just about Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse. There's a third subject. His name is Ub Iwerks, and you have not heard of him. There's a reason for that. Ub was Walt Disney's friend, colleague, and business partner for 10 years. He and Walt straddled the line between success and failure together for a decade. If Walt was a wizard, Ub was the man behind the curtain. Ub created Mickey Mouse, and Walt dreamed up Mickey's actions. But a bit of prosperity changed both men. Walt became insensitive, and Ub resentful. Each day became a battle in how to best entertain through story. If their final year was a tug of war, Mickey Mouse was their rope. He was a child torn between two fathers. Seeing how Mickey acts in any particular cartoon or comic strip is a shorthand for who won the argument the day it was produced. Walt's Mickey and Ub's Mickey were very different. Walt preferred the aw shucks Mickey, the bashful guy you see who pinks up if Minnie gives him a peck on the cheek. Ub preferred the man of action, the Mickey you see in a park attraction taking arms against a dragon every night. Neither man realized the irony in their preferences. For in real life, Walt was the brash one, while Ub was retreating and kind. Each of their Mickeys was an idealized version of their partner. Ub's half of Mickey was Walt's daring-do soul. Walt's half was Ub's golly-gee heart. Mickey is a friendship personified. After a year of grappling with each other, Ub called it quits and left. Walt stayed. Confoundingly, most other Disney books stop the Ub and Walt story at this point. That's when it really gets good. The whole story is here, for the first time. What does creation truly mean in the case of Mickey Mouse? Who made him? Was it the person who drew Mickey? The first person who animated him? The person who supplied his voice? Who crafted his go-getter personality? Who spun together the slapstick hijinks and dance moves he pulled off with such élan? Who cast Mickey as the synecdochical mouse for a company? For a way of life? For America itself? Walt's and Ub's lives were forever intertwined. Both tried, but neither man was able to escape the other for long. They were bound together like the legendary interwoven tales of rodents known as a Rat King. Both men are gone now, but their creation lives on, and will for generations. Mickey's humble mouse's eye view height will be this book's perspective. If you're new to the wonderful world of Disney, you won't believe how much the world changed thanks to one mouse being set loose in a theater. If you're a Disney expert, hopefully you'll see behind the scenes of the Hollywood history you thought you knew. Part 1. Missourians, 1928 to 1929. Move! You're a mouse, not a man. You've got to scurry. Kate DiCamillo, The Tale of Despero. Chapter 1. Lightbulb, 1928. I can't say just how the idea came, Walt Disney said regarding the birth of Mickey Mouse. There was no eureka moment, no grand vision, no Galatea. Creation is boring, even for the creation of the greatest character of all time. Mickey may be a worldwide draw now, but he started as a single drawing. He was first sketched in Los Angeles, California, in March of 1928. The mouse was drawn on a piece of two-hole punch paper, the animator's bread and butter. That piece of paper was divided into six panels and filled with mice. After enough attempts, a decent candidate emerged. That's it. No book of Genesis grandeur. Mickey was drawn with a pencil on a sheet of paper, just like every other of the world's infinite doodles. But that's all wet as an origin story. Walt grew tired of giving such an unsatisfying, unvarnished answer to the question of how he invented Mickey Mouse. He was a showman, after all. He couldn't be expected to keep punting his response. People are so eager to hear, Dorothy Parker said, about the process of legends, that you haven't the heart to send them away empty. If fans wanted a legend, there was no better storyteller than Walt Disney. The pentimentoed legend of Mickey Mouse that Walt created has been retold by corporate histories, documentaries, biographies, and even an episode of Drunk History. Walt took years to get it right. It is a microcosm into how he worked as an artist. The legend is best summed up by French artist Pascal Witasek, who makes posters for imaginary films. His one sheet for a movie called Walt, directed by Ron Howard, which seems right, features a thin, mustached Ryan Gosling in an empty train car, happily drawing on a pad. Crumpled paper is all around him. The green plains of the Midwest roll by out his cabin window. In the sweet blue sky floats three clouds that form a familiar silhouette. Walt's creation of Mickey Mouse on a westbound train has become an indelible piece of American lore. It's the cultural equivalent of Betsy Ross sewing the first American flag, George Washington felling the cherry tree, or Abner Doubleday inventing baseball. It's also just as flat-out wrong. Walt Disney did know he needed a new character while riding the rails, but he spent most of his time fuming, not sketching. He was a raging lion on the train coming home, said his wife Lily, who spent the trip in fear and worry. All he could say over and over was that he'd never work for anyone again as long as he lived. He'd be his own boss. Walt, an emotional man on normal days, returned to his L.A. cartoon studio in a funk unusual even for him. His creative partner, Ub Iwerks, called it one of the absolute low points in Walt's life. His brother and other partner, Roy Disney, agreed. He really didn't have anything. The only thing Walt could count on, in fact, was family. Roy was Walt's biological brother. Ub was Walt's kindred spirit. They'd worked on and off in movie-making since 1919 when they were barely adults. Roy was a former banker. He was the business's money man. Ub was their talent. He drew as fast as Jesse Owens running downhill. Walt was the dreamer. His ideas were a corny mix of schmaltz and yucks. They had ventured from Kansas City to Los Angeles for the same reason as everyone else, the Golden State's gold-paved streets. The three owned Walt Disney Studios in Los Angeles's Silver Lake neighborhood. The studio had expanded in recent years, but all those employees were being lured to a competitor. Worse, that new competitor had taken away Disney's cartoon star. The trio of Walt, Ub, and Roy had mere weeks to gin up a replacement character and somehow make that new tune a star. If they didn't, the company was kaput. Cartoons were usually animals, but not just any animal would do. Cats were out, for instance. Felix the Cat, one of the stars of animation, had way too many literal copycat cartoons over the years, including one from Disney. Rabbits were out, too. The tune Walt just lost was called Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. That left the rest of Kingdom Animalia. While Roy watched, Ub and Walt started sketching a menagerie. Ub cranked out species after species. Horse, cow, frog, dog, even another cat. Walt, who started off as an animator but hadn't drawn in years, tried his hand at a mouse. It was tall and gawky like the mice Clifton Meek drew in Life magazine, but the idea was solid. The star should be a mouse. Ub took a clean sheet of two-hole punch to brainstorm a more easily drawn mouse. Animation is all about efficiency. The fewer lines it takes to make a character, the better. He needed a caricature of a mouse, not a real mouse. Ub's piece of paper survives and is in the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. Art historian Thomas Andre calls it a virtual Rosetta Stone of Mickey's creation. Let's call the first attempt, found in the upper left panel, Proto-Mickey. Proto-Mickey was a creature in high-water pants, a long-sleeved shirt, thin shoes, and a little Lord Fauntleroy bow tie straight off a dowager's bustle. The mouse was simple, short, and round. The animator in Ub used a lot of circles in the design. Circles were easy to draw. The more a torso looked like a snowman, the better. Proto-Mickey's face was startling as well. Ub drew a rat. That is, on the sliding scale of realism, his first attempt was much closer to mouse than man. Proto-Mickey's ears were round, but smaller and wide-set. His nose was long and thin, pointing down with whiskers. His hairline was low, which gave his eyes a sinister, greedy look. His tail was so long it almost completed a coil behind him. Worst of all was his mouth. There was the slightest arc of a smile, covered by a drooping snout overhanging his jaw. That mug wouldn't pass muster. Ub moved to other frames and tried again, sketching bodiless faces. Each face was a stutter step away from rodent and toward Mickey. The ears grew larger and closer together. The snout stayed, but more smile was added. The head was shrunk, which had the effect of making the huge eyes appear even larger. If they were drawn on the corner of a book, you could flip them to morph Proto-Mickey's head into his recognizable current form. After drawing a body clad in shorts and shoes onto his final head, Ub had his mouse. The next drawing Ub made was of a finished creature. He circled it in blue pencil. Success. Inside the blue circle was a shirtless mouse with a round belly and skinny arms. He was wearing two-button shorts, the style worn by young boys. He's missing his shoes and his ears are undersized, but that's Mickey Mouse. In the final frame, Ub dashed off a companion for Mickey. He used the same mouse design as Mickey, just with a short ruffled skirt. Some coquettish eyes, an S-curved tail, and arms in mid-swing completed the female mouse's flapper look. Mickey Mouse, meet Minnie Mouse. Ub's redesign of Walt's mouse was no triumph of creativity. Pear-shaped body, ball on top, couple of thin legs, Ub later said. If you gave it long ears, it was a rabbit. Short ears, it was a cat. Ears hanging down, a dog. Three aspects of Mickey's design made him unique. First, Mickey Mouse was a rodent of unusual size. Other cartoon mice were mouse-sized, but Mickey was the size of a child. This made him resemble the boys and girls who would be his audience. Disney experts Robert Hyde and John Gilman point out in a book that in a Depression Age survey, many children thought Mickey Mouse was supposed to be a cat or a dog. Mouse was just his last name. Second was an optical illusion. Ub had given Mickey a high forehead, like both he and Walt, with a widow's peak. Seen one way, the two dots above Mickey's nose were his mouse eyes. But seen another way, the dots were just the pupils, and his massive eyeballs went all the way up his widow's peak. Huge peepers or beady little eyes. You could imagine either. Third was those ears. When Ub designed Mickey's style sheet, a reference guide to how to draw him in different angles, he turned the ears into a joke. Like all Ub Iwerks jokes, it was not remotely funny, but it was essential for Mickey's popularity. The joke was this. No matter how Mickey stood facing front, back, or three-quarters profile, his two ears would always align in a 12-and-2 arrangement. Not having to account for his ear rotation was a classic Ub Iwerks animation shortcut, and it made every frame memorable and iconic. You always got Mickey's good side. Mickey Mouse's ears were more than impossible, though. Just ask a semiotician, a studier of symbols. These ears properly belong not to three-dimensional space, but to an idealized realm of notation, of symbolism, of cartoon resilience and indestructibility, John Updike wrote. Carl Jung pointed out that the circular ears represent wholeness, completion, the single most vital aspect of life. They've been associated with breasts, with bellies, and with religious trinities. Draw a Venn diagram of three interlocking circles. Your eyes will inform you that you've sketched Mickey. This is not apophenia, seeing order in randomness, but instead pareidolia, seeing human faces in randomness. Whenever two dots are above a line, we see a face. Whenever circles touch, we see Mickey. Oxygen molecules, overlapping pancakes, a plate of Oreos. Oh, Mickey, you're so fine. Ub would keep altering Mickey, never satisfied. That snout, for instance, would grow shorter and firmer, less of a muzzle than an overbite. Mickey would also get thicker, gain a forehead, and switch eyes a few times. But that was to come. On that March 1928 day, Mickey's creation was an easy labor. Ub delivered him in under an hour. That's the remarkably unremarkable truth. Mickey Mouse was born no differently than any other cartoon or poem or song was fashioned, by sweat equity, trial and error, and whatever other fancy names are given to the pedestrian act of making something up. Mickey was just a character model at that point, so the accomplishment wasn't much. Felix the Cat's creators were often asked where Felix came from. Animators knew the facts. Otto Messmer, the best animator in New York City, created Felix back in 1919. 6 years later, though, Felix's copyright holder, Pat Sullivan, started telling a different and more fanciful tale. Sullivan claimed his wife hauled a cat to the office one day and ordered her husband to make a cartoon about the puss. It was utter malarkey, but a good story. What was good enough for Felix was good enough for Mickey. Time to gag up the facts and add bits and pieces until it felt true. Ub may have invented Mickey the Mouse, but Walt would invent Mickey the Legend. The Mickey Legend, Take One. On a noisy, gimballing train car going from New York to California, a dejected Walt ponders his fate. He has lost Oswald, but he can make a new star. Rushing through the prairie states, he decides to replace the lost rabbit with a mouse and draws Mickey on a pad. This has some truth to it. Walt surely was thinking of an Oswald replacement on his long westward trip, but he didn't decide on a mouse until he and Ub were in the same room back in L.A., pencils in hand. Walt was taking sole credit for the shared idea, sole credit for Ub's execution, and backdating his actions to boot. The Mickey Legend, Take Two. The mouse's name gains a wrinkle. It can be found in a 1931 article in Windsor Magazine, which is credited to Walt. but he was probably the interview subject, not the author. In the piece, Walt claimed that Mickey was first called Mortimer Mouse. The name Mortimer checks out. Disney's previous two animal stars were named Oswald and Julius, and Mortimer is the same type of funny old-fashioned name. It seems plausible Mortimer was Mickey's original name, at least briefly. Time for Lily Disney's contribution. In a move right out of Pat Sullivan's playbook, Walt started giving some credit to his wife. He says Lily was the one who dismisses the name Mortimer as too fey, too sissy. She proposes a tough guy name, not the regulation Michael or the everyman Mike or the childish Mikey. M-I-C-K-E-Y. In some tellings, this christening happens on the train and sometimes back in L.A. The Mickey Legend, Take 3, circa 1932. This was actually a flashback. Picture this. Kansas City, 1922. During Walt's humble animation beginnings, he said he had trained a little mouse some tricks and kept him in a wire trash bin. When he moved out to L.A., he had to let the pet mouse go. Eventually, he'd add that the mouse was named Mortimer. The Mickey Legend, Take 4, circa 1933. Now we expand the flashback. Walt's desk contained multiple mice, a whole family. The story gains pathos with a new plot point. Walt had caught the mice to kill them, but they were just too dang cute to drown. While he toiled, Walt would tell them stories and play with them, and they kept him company while he drew. Also in this retelling, when he let the mice go, one of them refused to leave his master. Sniff. Walt upped the stakes even more in Take 5, and proposed that way back then, he had been writing pen pal letters to his 6-year-old niece. Those letters contained cartoon drawings of his mice. This retcon allowed Mickey, in fact, to precede all of Disney's other cartoon characters in existence. Walt didn't have a 6-year-old niece back then, but that was a quibble. The Mickey Legend, Take 5. Walt can claim no credit for this. It came from Mickey Rooney. Back in 1928, Rooney was a child star from Walt's hometown of Kansas City, famous for a series of shorts called Mickey Maguire. In his later years, Rooney claimed that during a film short, he wandered into Walt Disney on set, who was drawing a mouse. Walt introduced himself, said he was a fan, and offered to name the mouse after Rooney. This is hokum. Rooney worked on the Warner Brothers lot, and Walt would have no reason ever to be there. Also, Walt wasn't an animator anymore, and couldn't draw Mickey Mouse very well. Last, Mickey Rooney's real name is Joe Yule Jr. But let's not dismiss this claim too quickly. You see, Walt was not above cashing in on someone else's popularity, as his Felix the Cat copycatting attests. And Mickey Maguire was a popular kid series. It went toe-to-toe with Hal Roach's The Little Rascals. By borrowing the name Mickey, Walt could co-opt some of that youth appeal without the flagrancy of calling his new star, say, Alfalfa or Spanky. Want another namesake? There was a black-painted wooden mouse toy in the late 1920s. It was labeled Mickey. The origin story grew and grew. Like an inkblot, each version reveals more about the teller than the tale. Walt, well aware of this, often played games with interviewers, daring them to call him out on his hogwash. Other times he would offer a stretcher with a wink, indicating that what he said might not stand up in court. When Walt Disney's daughter Diane wrote a book about her father, she had to decide what parts of the Mickey legend to prune. Her version omits the chestnut about her mother naming Mickey. She also leaves out Ub Iwerks' role entirely. In her retelling, Walt made Mickey. Simple as that. On the other hand, the Disney-produced volume Mickey Mouse, 50 Happy Years, credits both Walt and Lily for Mickey's name and the plot of Mickey's first cartoon. The exhibit titled Walt Disney One Man's Dream, found in Disney Hollywood Studios in Orlando, tries to split the difference. It discreetly admits that the Mickey legend is part truth and part myth, But then it too excludes Ub's work in Mickey's creation. He is referred to simply as an animator and technician. Lily gets credit for changing Mortimer to Mickey. No language implies that Walt created Mickey Mouse, or that Ub Iwerks did not, but that's the message visitors infer. The exhibit is a lawyer's concoction, highly misleading but never dishonest. A third spin of the legend turns the myth on its rounded ear. Now it's a conspiracy. This version claims that Ub's Rosetta Stone artwork is a fake, created a year after Mickey's creation for promotional purposes. The world has mixed up a reproduction for the original, which is lost. If there even was an original, maybe Mickey was conceived over multiple sheets of paper, and the reproduction put it all in a handy one sheet. There could be truth in this. Disney ran ads with Proto-Mickey in the early 1930s. Amy M. Davis, who teaches animation history at England's University of Hull, inserts yet another conspiracy. She claims the Mickey legend is not an unanswerable mystery. Answers exist, but they are purposefully locked away in the Walt Disney archives. Disney would not benefit from revealing the truth, whatever the truth is, since it would only lead to disappointment. Without concrete answers, every faction gets to believe they are right. No matter how tangled the Mickey legend grew, Walt was a grand enough storyteller to always keep it believable. He also inspired others to invent origin stories for their toon stars from the same dyed lot of yarn as Mickey. Walter Lance, for instance, claimed that Woody Woodpecker began as a noisy bird that ruined his honeymoon. Over the years, the Mickey legend ended up dominating Walt's life. All elements of his childhood, painting cartoons on the wall of the house in tar, performing magic tricks, working so hard delivering papers on a cold winter's day he fell asleep in a warm apartment hallway, were recast. They were now preludes to the moment of creation on a Midwest train. Take away all the triumphs, and Walt's one core truth was that he was the man who made Mickey Mouse. He didn't make the first drawing, no, but the Mickey legend is based in truth. Walt Disney was Mickey Mouse's creator, as surely as Ub Iwerks was. Mickey isn't Mickey without both men. The mouse was their shared destiny, the end result of 10 years of toil, and the journey started in the heartland. Chapter 2. Show Me, 1920. Certain cities go hand in glove with decades. The world turns to revolve around them, lockstep in a sympatico time and place. San Francisco in the free love 1960s, Seattle in the grunge and dot-com 1990s, Chicago in the big-shouldered 1930s, New York in just about any decade. Add Kansas City in the 1920s to the zeitgeist list. A combination of bridges, railroad lines, and roads made it a Midwestern hub. In the decades before airplanes and interstates, KC was the biggest city for 1,000 miles. As the song goes, everything's up to date in Kansas City. Jazz may have been born in the brothels of New Orleans, but the music of America became a man in Kansas City, Missouri. Sax legend Charlie Parker welcomed visiting talent from the rest of the world to the Paris of the Plains. Bathtub gin sloshed all around the aptly named City of Fountains. Prohibition agents were paid to look the other way by political hacks like Tom Pendergast, so good at his job that one of his cronies, Harry S. Truman, became president. Kansas City lured in a cavalcade of up-and-comers ready to make a mark in the world. A young Ernest Hemingway, fresh from World War I, learned his snub-nosed prose at the Kansas City Star. Also raised in this rich milieu were director Robert Altman, anchorman Walter Cronkite, science fiction author Robert A. Heinlein, pitcher Satchel Paige, and an air-hearted girl named Amelia. What they all shared was a certain stateless nationality to them. Boston created Bostonians, Atlanta created Atlantans, but Kansas City created Americans. Two such American teenagers looking to make it big shook hands in October of 1919. Film historian William K. Everson said that no one year planted and nourished so many seeds of change as did 1919, and here were two acorns ready to sprout. They were new hires at a commercial art studio, though neither would survive the post-Christmas layoffs. One was a bit floppy-haired, the other was developing Edgar Allan Poe's intimidating brow. The older of the two men was all of 18, with an unpronounceable moniker, Ub Ert Iwerks. UBBE was pronounced Oob, although many, including some lifelong pals, kept saying Ub or Ubby. Ub's name and background were Frisian, the obscure northern European language that is the closest to English. Most people assumed he was Dutch. Ub's life had been defined by his father, Ert Iwerks, beginning with Ert naming him after his uncle Ub. Ert was a tinkerer and inventor, and always had a side project going. Ert had two previous families, wives and children in Iowa and elsewhere in Kansas City, and had bailed on them both when things grew sour. Ub inherited his dad's twin passions for art and the mechanical. When Ub was a freshman in high school, Ert went for a deadbeat dad hat trick, leaving his third family behind. Ert's breaks were clean. When he left, there were no goodbyes, no visits, and certainly no support checks. While he moved on to his fourth wife, Ub's mother, Laura May Iwerks, née Wagner, was left with no means of support. Ub became the man of the house. Laura May never recovered from Ert's betrayal. She became petrified of financial ruin and ordered Ub to leave school and enter a profitable field. Ub would not see sophomore year. Like many boys of the era, he dropped out of school at age 16 and started apprenticing for an engraving company. He had excelled in and enjoyed his art classes, but art was not his mother's idea of a stable trade. Listening to his mother again, Ub quit his art job to work at a farm in Arkansas for a year. He then returned to Kansas City, claiming a position at a commercial art studio called Pesman Rubin. He was good at lettering, a needed skill in the days before desktop publishing made 100 fonts a drop-down menu away. His mother remained wary of anyone with a creative spark. Once she yelled at one of Ub's bosses for corrupting her son since he, brace yourself, let Ub drink soda at work. His mom would never approve of any form of art as a profession. Ub had been at Pesman Rubin for a month or so when he met a new co-worker. Despite being a year younger than Ub, this kid had lived even more of a life. His name was Walter Diz. A good-hearted schemer, Diz had lived all around the country, Florida, Chicago, and a farm north of KC. He had held dozens of jobs, gone overseas to fight for his country, and was a talented sketcher. Diz lived with his brother, Roy, a banker, in a house on Bellefontaine Avenue. Diz had entered the war by joining the Red Cross, which only required you to be 17 to drive an ambulance. Diz hadn't even been that, so he forged his passport to pass for an adult. When he was overseas, he made a tidy profit selling German helmets to soldiers who wanted souvenirs. The helmets were authentic, but Walter painted them brown to muddy them up, and a co-conspirator actually fired a bullet through them to look battle-damaged. Forgery, scams, cons. Diz knew every trick in the book. Diz had his share of father issues, too. His pious father, Elias, had moved relentlessly, always chasing work. Their humble Protestant work ethic, all sons worked with all money going to the father, kept their family solvent. Diz had a hellish paperboy route, and Elias kept all of that money, too. Diz's older brothers ran away. Elias was so upset he would burn their letters unread. The father had finally found success with a jelly factory up in Chicago. That left Diz on his own. Ub never talked about his own father, too painful, but he saw a shared soul in Diz. Uptight Ub was an irresistible target for Diz's trickster side. Diz sometimes called Ub the hillbilly for his gullibility. One time, Diz set Ub up on a date with a woman who clearly didn't like him. The next day, Diz announced to the whole office he had a new movie to show them. He He set up the projector, threaded the film, and showed hidden camera footage of Ub's awful date. Ub was mortified. During downtime at work, Diz practiced his lettering, using variants of his own name. W.E. Disney. His full name was Disney. Walter Elias Disney. Walt E. Disney. Diz asked Ub, who preferred to kill time by playing poker, which version looked best. Whatever Ub picked, Diz would start using professionally. Ub chose Walt Disney, despite Walter usually not going by either Walt or Disney. Diz agreed and became Walt Disney from then on. In accidental reciprocity, Walt kept mispronouncing Oob as Ub. That stuck too. Oob Iwerks would be simplified to Ub Iwerks. Both boys had rechristened each other. The downtime that allowed for pranks and poker grew to be a problem. Walt was let go in December 1919, and Ub followed him January 1920. So much for their careers in the arts. Walt was an old pro at scrounging up factotum jobs, and he became a mailman. Ub had to support his mom, who never left his side, or for that matter, believed in him. Despite his obvious talent, Ub was a bit of a wallflower. A canceled stamp in flapper lingo. He didn't know how to scam a job, but Walt surely did. So Ub paid a visit to Walt's house asking for help. Perhaps the animated man could aid the mousy man. Walt, it turned out, didn't need money. He had $500 banked from his Red Cross service, but he was incapable of not working. His resume included stints as a delivery boy, news butcher, they sell snacks on a train, paperboy, and security guard. And he had an idea. Based on their 6 weeks of art studio experience, Walt proposed that he and Ub go into business as their own two-man studio. Ub was the talent, Walt would be the hustler. That day, the two starving artists decided to partner up in a commercial art business. First things first, they needed a studio. Walt had a plan. He and Ub started working out of a local throwaway newspaper's spare bathroom. They built light boards for desks and paid the rent and spare work for the paper. Now all the Iwerks Disney commercial artists firm needed was paying gigs. Ub got first billing in their name because a company called Disney Iwerks sounded like an optician's shop. They designed a masthead for a leather workers union's newsletter, drew an oil well for a petroleum company's prospectus. You should have seen the amount of oil we got into those drawings, Walt said, and moved out of the bathroom into a real office. They made $135 the first month, which they split two ways. It was enough to pay one man, but not two, Ub said. Commercial art was not Walt's forte. Walt was a cartoonist, not an artist, Ub said. His biggest ambition in those days was to have a comic strip of his own. They tried to sell a strip to the syndicates, mocking up samples with fake newspaper articles around it to look like it was actually published. Maybe that was how they'd make it big. Not with lettering, but by becoming the next Gasoline Alley or Barney Google. It wasn't to be. Walt and Ub soon disbanded. Partly this was because clients saw through their act. They were two teenagers playing grown-up. But it was also because a local film company, which with Razzle Dazzle changed names three times in as many years, from the Kansas City Slide Company to the Kansas City Film Ad Company to United Film Ad Service, needed a full-time cartoonist. Ub was the better cartoonist of the two, so he could hold down that job while Walt chased down piecemeal work Ub could do after hours. This would ensure a steady stream of income for Iwerks Disney. But Walt took the job for himself, leaving shy Ub to toot his own horn, and Walt doing work Ub could have done better. It was a bad call for both. The inarticulate Ub didn't last long as a salesman, and was reportedly sketching loved ones' tombstones for money. He declared bankruptcy after 2 months. I think it's important to have a good hard failure when you're young, Walt once said. Here was Exhibit A. Ever the slickster, Walt convinced his new boss to hire Ub as a staff artist. Disney biographer Timothy S. Suzanin suggests Walt took the job just to get Ub's foot in the door. Ub's salary ended up $5 less per week than Walt's. The discrepancy always bothered Iwerks, Walt said later. He was older. He'd been in the business longer. For the third time in 6 months, Walt and Ub were co-workers, and working in the movies. Well, making the title cards for ads before The Silence in one market. But still, as the joke about the man who carries the shovel behind the elephant goes, that's show business. Some of the ads used a technique the French called Le Mouvement Américain, cut-out animation. A paper doll was posed on a flat background, photographed, and then reposed. Do that 100 times, and the paper doll will dance. But it didn't dance convincingly, even by 1920 standards. Audiences already knew cheap when they saw it. Animation breaks all the rules of nature. It snaps Newtonian physics in half. Characters stop on a dime. Velocity is based on willpower instead of speed and direction. And for every action, there might not be any reaction, much less an equal or opposite one. It also bites its thumb at Darwin. Animals with human traits are everywhere. Mass is created from nothing. Entropy is reversed in the blink of an eye, and the universal constants regularly take a pie to the face. Film audiences weren't content with the first rude cartoons, which replicated the word balloon puns of comic strips. They wanted visual puns, slapstick, and action. Winsor McCay's Gertie the Dinosaur was the first cartoon star back in 1914. Mutt and Jeff became as popular in animated form and as a live-action serial as they were in daily newspapers. The Fleischer Brothers' Coco the Clown has already crawled out of the inkwell, displaying motion-captured realistic movements thanks to the new process of rotoscoping, filming an actor then cartooning over each frame of his outline. Coco was joined by the Grouch Chasers, Colonel He's a Liar, and the Katzenjammer Kids. Biggest of all was the zoomorphic wonder Felix the Cat, who quickly became the world's favorite drawn face. They all made jangly paper cutouts look sophomoric. Ub and Walt could fix that. They hit the Kansas City Library, reading up on animation techniques the way aspiring magicians practice the cup and balls. Animators back then were considered not artists, but illusionists. Perhaps this is why Walt and Ub's most famous character would become a sorcerer. The first ever appearance of Disney magic, then, were modest improvements in paper doll animation. There were loads of other shortcuts available for a clever animator. In Gertie, for instance, the static background was often redrawn from scratch every frame. It was far easier to draw one static background. A good animator saved time, stuck to character models, shaved seconds, worked smarter. Ub found a book of motion photographs. He credited animating a running greyhound for his biggest leap in learning. It was the best animation scene I ever did, before or since. The current way of photographing animation took two people. One person would feed a picture under the mounted camera. Animated stars were always filmed from above, Walt joked. The second person turned the hand crank a single revolution, clicking open the camera shutter for a single frame. Ub the Tinkerer came up with a motor that turned the crank with a flick of a switch. That invention halved the manpower need. Walt, for his part, tried to talk his bosses into paying for his and Ub's hand-drawn animation. No dice. Even his silver tongue had its limits. As a conciliatory gesture, the boys were allowed to borrow the studio's camera after hours. Yet another business venture began. Films. Walt soon grew so committed to animation that he turned down a gig as a newspaper cartoonist. The boys made it easy on themselves the first time out. Their debut cartoon was only one drawing long. The minute-long short starts with a live-action Walt Disney, with a pipe and an accountant's eyeglass shade, but not yet his trademark mustache. In one unbroken shot, we see Walt's quicksilver hand flying across the screen, sketching and shading, perfection in motion. The drawing was already there. in non-reproducible blue ink that the eye could see, but a camera could not. All Walt did was trace over the non-repro blue. Walt's hand was another illusion. It was actually a cut-out photo of a hand, so it stayed in focus. A theater called Newman's bought this short and signed up for one every week. They were billed as Newman Laughograms. Newman paid 30 cents a foot, little more than Walt and Ub's costs to animate it. Animation like rope was sold by the foot. More lightning sketches followed, such as a shocking display of shapely legs and corseted busts, before streaks of glass revealed the image to be mannequins in a department store window. Toward the end of the Newman's run, Ub and Walt tried their hand at a true cartoon, featuring corrupt cops being kicked out of a police station. They drew one officer being vamoosed, then photographed the sequence a second time after darkening the officer's hair. Then they added a mustache and shot it a third time. This was called cycling. When used properly, cycling saved hours of repetitive work. When used poorly, it results in a cop wearing bad disguises. Cycled shots were called cheater shots for a reason. Add to that a misspelled caption, "You're fired," and it's understandable why Newman declined to re-up for more cartoons. The Laughograms were kaput. Like a cycle drawing himself, Walt started another venture. By day he worked at FilmAd, and by night he moonlighted at his newest venture, KC Studios. At KC, he experimented with trick photography, such as broken milk bottles reassembling in reverse, and tried to sell the footage to local advertisers. Ub stopped by to do some lettering for them, but mostly stuck to his new job, at an ad agency. It was at KC that the animation bug truly bit Walt. He aspired to make a cartoon of the fairy tale, Little Red Riding Hood. He wanted it to be as good as one of Paul Terry's Aesop's Fables. He worked for months on it, but he needed help. Borrowing a play from a fellow Missourian, Tom Sawyer, Walt decided to invite local art students to come study cartooning with him. Their study was unpaid labor on Walt's Little Red Riding Hood. For extra credit, maybe they could whitewash his fence. Walt was quite alone during this time. Ub wasn't involved. His brother Roy was carted off to Arizona after developing pneumonia, and their parents had sold the family house and moved to Oregon. Walt rented a bed in a rooming house and spent all his time working. KC would not fail the way the Newman films and Iwerks Disney did. From his hospital bed, Roy sensed his brother was struggling and mailed a blank check good for up to $30. Walt used every cent. The completed Little Red Riding Hood was the world's first Disney-fied story. Walt's version begins with a middle-aged woman throwing dough in the air. A clever cat makes donuts by shooting holes in the dough with a shotgun. Walt was still learning how to pace a story, because this opening takes 2 full minutes. The woman blows a whistle. Remember, there's no sound yet, so you'd have to imagine the tweeting sound. And 2 stick figures emerge from the whistle and begin to tango. A young girl with a white hood, no color yet either, grabs the donuts, gets into a car from Little Red Riding Hood's garage, and heads out. After Little Red's dog helps her fix a flat tire, she meets a mysterious stranger, our big bad wolf. Walt chose to portray the wolf as human, which strips away metaphor to reveal a queasy underneath. The wolf races to get to grandmother's house first, taking numerous shortcuts that send him flying over hills and bouncing over water. Now for a softer touch. Instead of eating Granny, the wolf discovers a note saying she ran into town. He waits in the empty house and jumps Little Red as she enters. The words, "Help! Help!" escape in puffs of steam from the door before the whole house starts quivering from the struggle within. Little Red's dog escapes and alerts a handsome pilot. Pilot and dog take off, speed lines raking their plane, and manage to overturn the house thanks to a grappling hook. The pilot rescues Little Red while the wolf hops into his car to escape. He's foiled when the pilot drags his getaway car into a lake. Little Red kisses the pilot, and the little dog covers his eyes, because kissing is gross. The end. Disneyfied means different things to different people, and all are on display here. Updating a classic story? Dulling the sharp edges of the plot and sharpening the dulled edges? Adding new characters, new storylines? Both heightening and lessening the emotional stakes? A happy ending? This was how Walt told a story.